Just for everyone's information, there is a recording available for the past two classes. I think it's on YouTube even. You can also find it through the Ramat Hara website, so feel free to check those out if you missed the first two classes or you just want to go over them. All right, so today's topic, the third topic, and because Purim is coming up on Sunday, it'll be the last topic on the Megillat Esther, is going to be about what I called Esther's legacy, rethinking diaspora Jewry. And one of the major themes of Megillat Esther is the fact that the Megillah is the only book in Tanakh to not take place in the land of Israel, but rather to take place outside of Israel, in exile, if you exclude, the Torah itself, which that's, I guess, pre-Israel. But anything in terms of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, it's the only other book that describes the events, outside of Israel. And it changes the way that we think about the book. For many, especially in Israel, this is a very common refrain, to talk about this book as a book of the Galut, a book of the exile, about the exile, for the exile. And what I want to do is, especially considering the events of this year, I know that there has been a lot of talk amongst Americans of the, death of the golden age of American Jewry. I don't know whether I'm not a historian. I certainly do not know the truth about that, but it's I'm certainly can give you my opinions. But it is true that many people have thought about Aliyah this year in a way that they haven't as seriously in years past. And in that light, the Megillah presents a certain context or a certain avenue of looking at these type of world events, which I think can be rather illustrative. So that's kind of the background, the what I kind of want to start off with as we begin this question of looking at the Megillah. I'm going to share my screen, and I'm going to also share, in case someone wants to see the source sheet directly. You can kind of see the source sheet, so let me send it to you right now. Yeah, someone pointed out that Daniel is also out of Israel. Yes and no, because it actually begins in Israel. It goes back and forth. It's also a lot of the technically, it's mostly in Israel, but a lot of the events and the prophecies are about what will concern Israel specifically. So it's a little bit different in that Esther is entirely outside of Israel. It makes no reference really to the land of Israel. So here's the link to the document. If you want to see it, I'm going to just share my screen so you can follow along with me. And I want to begin with the following point. Am I always having trouble finding this? Okay, here. Okay. So the story of Esther, as many people know, begins as follows. It was in the times of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was the king from Hodu until Kush, 127 different provinces, and the story continues. I want to right away start off with the following question, which the Gemara, or the Mishnah really, in Megillah presents. The Mishnah quotes as follows. Where does someone have to read the Megillah in order to fulfill their obligation? Kind of a strange question. Presumably, I would have assumed you need to read the whole Megillah. Like, why would you only read part of it? But the Gemara presents three different views. Rabbi Meir Omer Kula. Rabbi Meir said, in order to fulfill the obligation of reading Megillat Esther on the night and the day of Purim, you have to read the whole thing. Rabbi Yehuda said, you have to read Me'ish Yehudi, right, from the beginning of in beginning of the second chapter, where we are introduced to Mordechai, and Rabbi Yossi Omer Me'achar HaDvarim Ha'ela, from the beginning of the third chapter, where we're introduced to Haman. What are they debating? In effect, presumably, they seem to be debating, what's the main part of the story? Is the main part of the story from the beginning, meaning from, talking from Achashverosh's party? Is the beginning from when we're introduced to Mordechai and therefore also to Esther? Or is the beginning really about Haman and Haman's plot and how we were able to survive Haman's plot? So there's interesting questions to be asked in terms of how to read the Megillah that this question raises. But I want to almost begin with perhaps a more simple question, which is, why do we begin with chapter one at all? Right, why do we begin Megillat Esther with this question of Bimei Achashverosh, this whole big party that Achashverosh has, this ginormous thing, and then he kills Vashti, and then he has to search for a new wife. Why do we have all of that? Not only are there no Jewish characters in that first chapter entirely, there barely are in the second chapter until, Esther comes to the scene. But perhaps more surprisingly, if you think about the timeline of the events, we're told that, right, think about the years that take place in the in Megillat Esther. We're told that Ahasuerus is his king, and when does he have his party, his big 180-day party? He has it in the 3rd year of his reign. Then, in that party, at the end of the party, he kills his wife Vashti. He looks for a new wife, and we're told that by the time he finds Esther, it is the 9th year of his reign. So 6 years later, in other words, the plot kind of skips from year 3 to year 9 between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Then chapter 3 begins the story of Haman. And when does the story of Haman begin? What year is that? Anybody remember exactly what year that was? So the Megillah makes it clear because it says, when Haman has his pur, when he has his lottery, it's on the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign, so 3 years later. And the rest of the events of the Megillah, from chapter 3 through chapter 4, which is, chapter 3, he makes the lot, and the lot decides it's going to be next year on Adar 13. Right afterwards, Mordechai and Esther, they come up with their plan, they respond to it. All of that's within a matter of days. Mordechai ends up sending out his letters that after Haman has already been killed by the month of Sivan, so we're talking 2 months later. And the story wraps up by the following Adar, so 11 months later. By Adar 13, they have the fight. The 14th and 15th, they party, they celebrate. And that's really the entirety of Megillat Esther, the story. So, in terms of chronology, we don't always notice it because, the pacing of the story kind of feels the same. But effectively, we start off with chapter 3, we skip to chapter 9, and then we spend the book. The large majority of the story focusing all on 1 year. And not just 1 year, but really it's like a few days within that 1 year. And all of which is to really focus on this question, why then do we begin the story with this introduction about Achashverosh? Why do we start it from there? Well, what's the point? Why begin the story? Tanakh is not just a history book. If it is, it's a pretty bad history book. There's a lot of things missing from it, a lot of things that it doesn't have. We don't need the whole story of Ahasuerus. In fact, we barely even know who he was. I mean, there's a whole debate among historians as to who Ahasuerus was. But so why do we have this whole introduction? Any thoughts anybody want to share?
Well, it sets the scene of the power structure and I guess the persecution or I don't well, we kind of get the sense that the Jews were doing well because Mordechai was an important person.
Well, Mordechai himself's not really introduced till the second chapter.
Okay, but I'm just saying, okay, so the setting is just a foreign land, I guess, and
I mean, this is a rather long setting. I mean, it's one thing if the first chapter was a few verses, I understand. The first chapter is very long. It's the second longest chapter in the book. I mean, it's kind of fun. Like we're still kind of fresh, so most people don't realize how long it is. But it's a long chapter. If you tell your kids wait to blue until Haman comes up, it's a long time to wait.
I
Yeah.
think we get a. Go ahead.
I guess Pearl or yeah, somebody wanna.
okay, isn't it kind of setting the scene as to how the Jews have kind of fallen and they've kind of sunk kind of low that they're attending this party? That the Jews are, even though Mordechai, he's part of the Sanhedrin, yeah, he's that's fine, but the Jews themselves are slipping in their observance and they're falling into the trap of feeling like they're part of Shushan, and they're really not. And that could be why, they're bringing the destruction upon themselves.
Yeah, so actually, I do want to talk about that today, so I want to get back to that. I will say, and I'm going to admit this, it's in my own comments. What's a little bit difficult is that, the Jews don't really appear at all in the first chapter. So it's a little bit interesting in that, but I do want to come back to your point. Yeah, Chaim, do you have a point?
I think it actually connects back to last week. I think it's a portrait of Ahasuerus is primarily what it is. It's telling us who we're dealing with here, and maybe gets back into those questions from last week about, the role of Haman versus the role of Ahasuerus and stuff like that.
And his personality.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the probably the perhaps the easiest way to look at it, and really the framing of the whole story, has to do with Ahasuerus. The story begins with Ahasuerus, and in fact, the very end of the book, right, does not end with the way we would expect it to, with the story of Purim and Mordechai and Esther, and everyone's happy and celebrating, and they live happily ever after. That's not the end of the chapter. Instead, the book actually ends. Vayasam Achashverosh Mas ala aretz v'yehayam. Achashverosh puts taxes, and v'chol maaseh tokpug v'ratov v'arshagel Mordechai. The whole story of Achashverosh and all of the things he did and everything Achashverosh did—they're all written up in the chronicles. The story really ends with Achashverosh, begins with Achashverosh. If anything, the framing of the story really seems like we're focusing very much on Achashverosh, which certainly I'd agree with you, Chaim, kind of brings us back to what we talked about last week—that Achashverosh, in some ways, becomes almost this, is meant to be presented as a protagonist of the story, but in fact is almost like an anti-hero. He's surprisingly not in control, someone who's not, who's someone who's who's really not a model king in any way, and part of the story is a commentary on Ahasuerus. Any other theories besides that? Or thoughts? So I'll say one other thing before I get to what Pearl had been talking about. And I wanted to say that it's worth noting the story begins, Ahasuerus, we're introduced to him, and what is he doing that very beginning? He's throwing a very lavish party, right? A 180-day party, a feast. And that's not the only feast in Megillat Esther. In fact, Megillat Esther has more feasts than any other book in Tanakh. It has, by depending on how you count them, 10, 11 different feasts, right? Just think about it just in terms of counting them. We begin the story with a 180-day feast. Then afterwards, they have a 7-day feast just for the citizens of Shushan. Simultaneously, there seems to be a feast for the woman. But okay, maybe it's the same feast, different feast. Esther is then brought to the palace. Ahasuerus marries Esther. Right after he marries Esther, what does he do? He throws a feast. Haman becomes the next second in command. He buys effectively the Jews. He writes the letters, and Ahasuerus and Haman have a feast. Esther then conspires. How is she going to, be able to convince Ahasuerus to repeal his decree? So she invites him and Haman to a feast, and then she invites him to a second feast. And after that feast, you then at that feast, Haman dies. The Jews then throw their own feast, and then they throw a second feast, and it's over and over and over again. And I think I'm skipping a few even. There's so many feasts throughout the book. It's almost like the story is about these feasts. And the story, in many ways, is encapsulated, or maybe the paradigmatic feast we have is actually that kind of that first feast, this incredibly lavish, opulent feast that Ahasuerus throws for 180 days. And besides the commentary maybe on the Jews and the participation or Ahasuerus specifically, I believe part of the question of why we begin Megillah with this story, this chapter, is because we want to really focus on the setting. That the setting here of Megillat Esther is not just anywhere, but it's within Persia that has a very particular culture, this culture of these lavish and almost too lavish feasts, these feasts of 180 days. And there's something very specific about this feast that I want to get to. And I'll show you that the Gemara itself already kind of hints to that same point. Take a look, here we'll go back to the open the source sheet. If you take a look at the Gemara, the Talmud in da, da, da. Skip that part. The Talmud in a lot of things here. Okay. The Talmud in Megillah has a whole long discussion, explaining the various different parts of Megillah, and it works as follows: By Keshevet when the king sat, like Gemara says, b'shalosh, why is it that the king? Why the Gemara begins by saying Megillah says that when the king kind of began his rule, but then it only starts actually talking about his third rule, his third year. Why focus on his third year if we're going to talk about when he begins his rule? That's like Gemara's, kind of homiletic, question they ask on this topic. So Amar
Sorry,
Rava, Rava's response.
are we looking at the right screen? I just want to make sure
Yeah, I am certainly. Are you not?
we're looking at something about Tehillat.
Really?
It says something about Tehillat online, yes.
Okay, I'm not sure why that is. Let me... I. That's very confusing. Okay, still.
No, that's better.
And that's
Okay,
right.
I'm not sure that is. Sorry about that. I think I opened too many screens at once, so I think it's yeah, sometimes that's my problem. Okay, oh, I just lost it.
That it also looked interesting, but you're probably about to get to it later.
Yeah, we will probably get there later. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Oh, I know what screen I shared. Okay. Interesting. Although they're my notes, so you'll get there in a second. Okay, so the Gemara in Megillah says as follows: Ask the following question about the third of the Gemara. The Gemara says at one point, Amar Rava. Rava says, "Ma'i keshevet? What does it mean when it says keshevet that the king sat? What it means is that the king threw this party after he had been calmed down. He was able to be in peace, be with peace. Why? Amar Belshazzar chashav ana chashiv nevelot ina. He said there is this decree that everyone seems to know about, that in Daniel and other places we're told that 70 years is going to be the extent of the Babylonian exile. That's going to be the length of it. And so apparently Belshazzar, who is the son of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, one of the Babylonian kings, he thought that indeed after 70 years had gone by, everything was going to go great. And at that point, he throws this massive party. And that's when in Daniel, he has that dream and the blood's on the walls and he realizes it's not that way. And that very night, the Persians and the Medes come together and they ransack Babylonia and they take over and become the new power and the time. So Ahasuerus says that must be that he must have misread the calendar. He must have counted wrong. Instead, I'm going to reread the calendar and I'm going to say this must be 7 years. He read it from a different time. And right now, today, meaning the third in his third year, we have reached 7 years since the destruction. He counts, like Mara says, 45 years of Nebuchadnezzar's life, 23 years of his son, Tarti Didei, 2 years of him, Hashivim, so reached 7 years. So now at that point, I'm going to take out the utensils from the Beit HaMikdash and I'm going to use them. And indeed, the Talmud then goes on to explain how much of Ahasuerus' party focused on using parts of the Beit HaMikdash. So, for instance, we're told v'chelim mikelim shonim. The one of the common customs in terms of how you lean it is you lean in this, eichav trap of v'chelim mikelim shonim, where you kind of revoke eichav because it's meant to homiletically remember that these aren't just any utensils, but these are perhaps utensils from the Beit HaMikdash. The Gemara describes the fact that Ahasuerus was wearing the garments of the Kohen Gadol, all sorts of this Beit HaMikdash the depictions. Where does it come from? Where do we get this idea that the Beit HaMikdash was in some ways, present within this story? Like, it's a nice midrash, but where does the story itself come from? Any thoughts of where within the chapter itself we kind of get the idea of the Beit HaMikdash? Okay, so what I want to suggest is we take a look. Let's take a look again at that first chapter. I'm going to open back up, and I really hope I open the right screen again. No, okay. Let's see if you guys get the right. Okay, I think you guys have the right thing. Okay. So take a look again at that first chapter. We started off a little bit earlier, and the chapter begins describing Ahasuerus, and he says in his third year, he makes this party. And here I want to kind of read exactly what this party sounds like. Starting from verse 4. Behar oto et osher kavod malchuto, when he wanted to show the wealth of his kingdom, v'et yekar tiferet gedulato, and the glory of it, yamim rabim shmorim matyom for 180 days, uvimlot amim ma'ele asa melech lechol am anim sim b'shushan habira, v'migadol v'ad katan mishteshi v'at yamim. After this long party, he ends up making a party for the people in Shushan for 7 days, shiv'at yamim b'chatsar ginat bitan hamelech, in the courtyard of the garden of the house of the king. Not really clear exactly where this is, the king's palace, his garden, where exactly in the palace it is, but it certainly sounds like he has a big palace, because there's a very, you know, lavish description here. And then the party specifically, we're told, contains all sorts of these really opulent decorations. Chur, karpas, tchelet, achuz bechav levut, ve'argaman, gelile chasef, amude shesh, mitot zahav v'chasef, alitzpat bahat v'shesh, v'dar v'socharet. There were all sorts of different colors of wool and fine linen and really beautiful marble and alabaster and mother of pearl and all sorts of things that architects know, and honestly I barely know what exactly these are, but these are very fancy garments and decorations and all sorts of really fancy things. And there's golden utensils to be able to drink from, and you're never repeating cups. Every cup you use is a new cup because there are so many different cups around. It's this incredibly lavish party. Somebody a comment? But what I want to point out is it's not just a question of how lavish the party is, but there's something fascinating about the way that this party describes and kind of gives us a sense as to who or what Ahasuerus is. So first off, I'll point out that when you have the description in verse 6, take a look again in verse 6. For karpasu tchelet achuz bechav levut ve'argaman, we have the description of various clothing. Now, clothing is something which appears in Tanakh many times, but these specific materials that are being used are materials that are rather mentioned more often than not in context specifically of the Beit HaMikdash. So for instance, the description of Tchelet, this almost royal blue, comes up, for instance, I'll tell you, 49 times in Tanakh. Of the 49, 42 of them has to do specifically with the temple or the Mishkan. Likewise, we're told that Bechav Levut, and this fine linen, which also almost exclusively is about Tanakh, is mentioned when it comes to the Mishkan. Or Argaman, also it's like this beautiful purple wool, almost exclusively is described when we talk about the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash. And it's not just the utensils or the various like fancy opulent things that here are described. It's even the description of the building itself. We have, although we don't have these, you know, architectural plans that described explicitly in the Megillah, we do get the sense from the various stories within the Megillah of this sense of what the building looked like. Right, we're told already in chapter 5, in verse 5, that there is a chatsar ginat bitan hamelach. There's a courtyard, there's a garden, there's a house. Later on, we find out that Vashti makes a party in Beit HaMalchut. She makes her own party somewhere else, so there's another fancy hall. We're later on told when it comes to when the women are collected for Ahasuerus to sample various pretty women of the kingdom, that they are all staying in Beit HaNashim, in the king's, in this house or this building dedicated specifically for the women. And after they spent the night with Ahasuerus, they then are transferred over to another building, to the place where the Pilachim, where the king's concubines are kept. And it's not just that, but we're told, beginning of chapter 5, of the fact that Esther is standing outside of the inner courtyard, right? She's talking very descriptively about this courtyard, that she's going to approach the king, and how you have to approach the king. Haman, in the chapter 6, goes and stands in front of the courtyard of the king's place. We consistently get back again and again to like various parts of the king's palace. And I don't have just from the Megillah itself, I wouldn't be able to come up with like a drawing of what it looks like. But you do get the sense that there's a lot of pieces here. And in fact, we actually do have I think I mentioned this very, very end of last week, but archaeologists in the 1800s French archaeologists were able to explore Persia, or now Iran, and dig up many of the ruins of Susa. Susa is the ancient city of Shushan. And you can actually see, I mean, the building, we do have a lot of the ruins. Nowadays, I think, as I understand, most of the archaeological site has been destroyed by various wars, and Westerners are not particularly invited in Iran. But here's like a drawing that actually comes. This is not like, I know it's drawing a little bit, looks like it comes from like a temple book, but it actually comes from the Museum of Archaeology in France. So this is actually their drawing that like one of the archaeologists there depicted. And you can kind of see, I mean, this is a huge, huge building. I mean, it's not really to scale, but you can kind of get the sense on the left side of this building, you have this this gatehouse, which, you know, you can kind of see the ramp. You don't see the full ramp, but that's the gatehouse where Mordechai is hanging out. Shaar Beit HaMelech is hanging out in front of the gatehouse. And then you have this huge, huge building with all these different parts and these huge different rooms. This, you know, it's hard to tell just from the scale here, but this is a ginormous palace. Now, why does it matter?
Those are people, I think. Those little blobs, so you can tell how big it is.
Yeah, I think that's kind of give you a sense of how big it is. And in fact, I mean, if you ever visit Iran and you can go to Susa, you can see. I mean, I can point out. I don't have it right here, but I can show you a picture of the way that the grounds are huge. It's a very long, extensive like archaeological dig. It's very large. So why is this important? I mean, the archaeology itself is interesting in its own right, and maybe it tells us a little bit about the Megillah. But more than that, in all of Tanakh, there are a number of big buildings, a number of big palaces that take place. We're told the different place people who live in big places. But what's fascinating is we don't have a description of the building ever. We barely have it. We don't have a description of Paro's palace in Mitzrayim. You don't have a description of Nebuchadnezzar's palace or the king of Assyria or, you know, any of these other kings. Even Shlomo, who were described a little bit of his building, it's rather sparse on details. The only place in all of Tanakh where we have descriptions of buildings are, number one, Achashverosh, and number two, the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. And there's something striking about the fact that the Beit HaMikdash comes up as the only parallel here in this story. And I believe it's very much intentional. The point being that this story is meant to evoke, at least within the background, the concept of the temple. And it's not just. Part of the reason there is partially about Achashverosh, maybe trying to compete with the temple. We saw the Gemara itself tries describing, you know, homiletically that Achashverosh throws his party when he thinks the temple is not going to come back. All that's really interesting. But it's not just about Achashverosh. It has equally, or perhaps even more significance, when it comes to the Jews specifically. The story of Megillat Esther begins with the story of Achashverosh. Who was Achashverosh? Which king was Achashverosh? Who was he? Anybody know historically?
Xerxes.
So there's a bit of debate. What?
Ataxerxes.
Yeah, so there are two different Xerxes. There are two Ataxerxes. There's the first and the second. Both of them, I mean, I'm not like, we can go through the history of the Archimedean dynasty. It's like 10 different generations. The first of that generation was Cyrus. Afterwards came Xerxes, a few others, Darius, a few other kings, Ataxerxes. I'm not here to debate exactly which of the Xerxes it was, the first or the second one. But what is interesting to point out is that regardless of which one it is, both of them follow after Cyrus. Now, why is it important that it comes after Cyrus? Because Cyrus, as we find out not from Megillat Esther, but we find out from the book of Ezra, did something really important. Cyrus made a decree that the people that all the Jews, and this is in fact not just the Jews. In fact, you can see the like the actual decree. The British Museum in London actually has like a scroll that was given to all the various populations within the Persian Empire, but they were given permission to go back to their ancestral lands and rebuild their temple. And indeed, beginning of Ezra, we're told that people were allowed to go back to the Beit HaMikdash, enter back into Israel. And what's worth noting is that all of that precedes the story of Megillat Esther. Meaning, we think of Megillat Esther as a story where everyone's in exile because there's no choices, because, you know, there is the land of Israel. But that's not really accurate. All the Jews that we discussed in Megillat Esther are in Israel, or sorry, are in, you know, in Persia by choice. Now, of course, you know, it's not that there's an easy flight you can take to Israel. Certainly, it's hard to travel and you have to uproot your life. It's, you know, a lot of difficulties that come with it. But if they wanted to, they could go to Israel. And they and their ancestors and their parents in front of them and their children chose, for whatever reason, not to. And so the background underlying this whole story is this story about the temple, story about the Beit HaMikdash, those who return there and those who haven't. Here's something really interesting that not everyone realizes about the story of Megillat Esther. I want to show you the chapter 4 in the book of Ezra. So Ezra begins with the decree of Cyrus that everyone can return to the land of Israel if they want to. And indeed, a bunch of people did go back to Israel, led by Zerubbabel, the prince of Judah who leads people back to Israel. And in chapter 4, we're told as follows. As part of the journey back into Israel, not everyone was very happy with that. In fact, in very much reminders of, you know, modern times, the local population that lived in Israel at the time were very unhappy. They did not want the Jews here. And so we're told that the people who were in Israel sent a letter to the king stating the following. I'm going to read this in English. I could read it to you in the original Aramaic, but...
You might be on your notes screen again.
I'm on my notes screen again?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
They're good notes. They're good notes, but I think you meant the other
one. I don't think the notes are that. I don't think the notes are that. Oh. Okay, now I know why. Okay, I see what it is. Okay. So I want to read to you the book of Ezra, the chapter 4. It's in Aramaic, so I'm going to read it in English. Though you can read the original if you'd like on top in Aramaic. But we're told as follows. So Rehum, the commissioner, and Shimshai, the scribe, who are various leaders, I guess, various provincial governors at the time, wrote a letter concerning Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes, or in the text it's called Malach Achashverosh. That's the way that the Hebrew has it, as follows. They write him a whole letter complaining that the Jews are doing this and they're rebelling. And the king, meaning Artaxerxes or Achashverosh, responds to them as follows. To Rehum, the commissioner, and Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their colleagues who dwell in Samaria and the rest of the province beyond the river, greetings. Now the letter that you wrote me has been read to me in translation. At my order, a search has been made, and it has been found that this city has from earliest times risen against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been rife in it. Powerful kings have ruled over Jerusalem and exercised authority over the whole province and beyond the river, and tribute, poll tax, and land tax are paid to them. So therefore, issue an order to stop these men. This city is not to be rebuilt until I so order. Take care not to be lax in this matter, or there will be much damage and harm to the kingdom. This letter was sent, and indeed they hurried to Jerusalem to stop the Jews by force. This is the letter which appears in the book of Ezra. And it's worth noting that we have, in this case, a letter that is written about the Jews in the time period of Achashverosh. And I think I cut it out, but this letter specifically is actually sent in the 12th year of this king's rule, which might make you think about the fact that is it possible that Achashverosh sent out two letters in the same year about Jews, one that Haman wrote and one was this? It's certainly possible. But perhaps more logical would be to say that the two stories here are actually the same story. that the letter that the Jews of Shushan received to kill all the Jews of Shushan are seen by the Jews in Israel in a very different light. And there it's not only about killing the Jews, but it's more specifically about stopping the temple from being built. And we have then two stories from different perspectives sharing the same exact perspective. One from the Jews in Shushan and one from the Jews in Israel. The same way that if we tell the story of October 7th, 2023, there's a different perspective for the Jews in Israel and the Jews in New York City. You know, we can each kind of tell our perspective in our own way and the way that the world responded. Why is this so important? It's not because the story of the Jews in Shushan doesn't matter. It does matter. It has significant effect. And if anything, the story proves that, you know, the Jews in Persia were able to save everyone else. But what's significant is that you don't have any reference throughout the Book of Megillat Esther about the events in Israel. And that's rather surprising because while the Book of Esther is very much focused on what happens in Shushan, what happens simultaneously when we read the Book of Ezra and Nehemiah is we find out that the way that the Jews in Israel were living was not particularly good. They were struggling. They had a lot of monetary problems. Think about or contrast the lavish, opulent party that Ahasuerus had, this 180-day feast, and then the 7-day feast, and all this money that everyone has, and the fact that the Jews, while they live in Shushan, we don't know explicitly exactly how wealthy they were, excuse me, but we do get a sense that they were living well, or at least decently well. But on the other hand, the Jews in Ezra and Nehemiah who lived in Israel, they lived quite poorly. In fact, we have a number of stories that the book, I'll just quote to you very briefly. For instance, the story, chapter, I have English here, I didn't include the English here, but the story in chapter 5 of Book of Nehemiah describes a story where Nehemiah comes back to Israel and there's a whole cry by all of the men and the children and all the various people who are complaining that they have no food. And that reason, as we kind of keep reading, we discover is that they have no money for food. Instead, they've been borrowing money from some of the very wealthy members, very wealthy Jews, and they effectively have lost all of their belongings. They are living in famine. They are struggling to survive. And this is just one story of several stories that appear in Ezra and Nehemiah depicting the challenges that the Jews in Israel have, which are, by contrast to what's happening in Shushan, almost third world problems. They're barely subsiding. You have the sense that, you know, they really need basic help, and they're not receiving it. And the Jews in Shushan, as important as their story is, we don't ever get this larger story about what happens in Israel. And it's not just that the story of the Jews in Shushan doesn't matter. But when you contrast it with every other book in Tanakh, where Israel is the focus, there's something rather shocking about the fact that Israel is not mentioned throughout Megillat Esther. Any thoughts so far about the lack of Israel mentioned? So I want to, in that light, look at the very end of Megillat Esther, perhaps the part where by then most people have either spaced out because it's been a very long chapter 9. But in the very end of chapter 10, we have the short, very short ending, three verses, famous three verses that everyone likes to boo sometimes. We're told as follows in the very end of, this is the way that Megillat Esther ends. Vayasem HaMelech Ahasuerus Mas al aretz v'yehayam, Ahasuerus placed a tax on the lands and the sea and the islands. V'chol masei tokpo gvurato farshat gidulat Mordechai, asher gidulo hamelach, haloim k'tuvim, asefer divrei hayamim l'malchei madai ufaras, all of the actions of Ahasuerus, the greatness of him, as well as the things that he did for Mordechai, all written in the chronicles of the kings of Medo-Persia. Ki Mordechai Hayudi Mishne Melech Ahasuerus VeGadol LaYehudim VeRathulero VeChab VeReish Tov LaAmo VeDever Shalom LaChol Zaro. For Mordechai was highly regarded by the Jews, was very popular, and looking to do good for all of his kindred. Why does the story of Esther end this way? Right, we kind of talked briefly about why it begins where it does with the party, but why does it end here? Specifically, I mean, the last verse I can understand thematically, Mordechai's greatness. Okay, that makes sense. But why are we starting with the tax? Why is there mention here of taxing?
Akate of the Ahasuerus aninon.
Yeah, so certainly one possible answer has to do with the fact that we're trying to point out that we're still ultimately Ahasuerus's. That's what Tomlin's answer is, that we still are Ahasuerus's servants. We're not, you know, free entirely. As much as there is redemption here, we're still under Ahasuerus's rule. Absolutely. Any other thoughts about that? So there are a few different theories I'll just mention briefly. Some people want to suggest that perhaps the taxes here are meant to, you know, fill up the coffers of the king, which I guess weren't filled up the same way because when Haman made his plot to kill the king, kill the Jews, I guess since it didn't really happen, maybe the king's coffers didn't really get filled up. So maybe this is the way to kind of fill them back up. That's kind of one way of looking at that some people suggest. But I want to suggest that the focus here is true, it's on Ahasuerus, but who is the one who's sending out Ahasuerus's letters? Who is the one who's in charge of Ahasuerus's financial policies?
Mordechai.
Mordechai is in charge of Ahasuerus's financial policies. And on the one hand, there's certainly something, you know, almost redemptive about the ending where Mordechai is in charge. Mordechai is not just, you know, some random person, but just as Haman was second in command, now Mordechai is. We really have this full, you know, the Nahapochu, this full change of events where now the Jews are on top. But the Megillah ends not with the greatness of Mordechai only, but also specifically with taxes. And I don't think it takes a modern person, you know, living in 2024, who has to fill out their taxes still, to be upset with taxes. No one's ever liked taxes historically. And so imagine you are some random person living in Persia. You have nothing to do with Jews. You're not anti-Jews. You're not pro-Jews. You have nothing to do with Jews. But what you do know is that there used to be an advisor, Haman, and, you know, he was fine. He didn't have anything to do with you. All of a sudden, this Jewish advisor comes around, and soon afterwards, taxes are levied against you. And that's not a very good feeling. That's not something that would make you particularly like the Jews.
It's like Yosef.
Yes, it's exactly like Yosef. Because there is this parallel that really spans almost the entirety of Megillat Esther between Yosef and the story of Yosef and the story of Esther and Mordechai. Really almost from the very beginning, we have this sense of the topsy-turvy world. Esther, we have, you know, the sense of Yosef, like Mordechai, ends up becoming, you know, second in command, saving people with the food and all these different things. And, you know, there's a dream that plays a prominent role in the middle of the night. There's so many different parallels between the story of Yosef and Mordechai and Esther. We can talk about for a while what the meaning of the parallels are. But certainly one of the meanings or the important point is, how does the story of Yosef end? Well, Yosef saves his siblings and shows, you know, that God is the one ultimately behind the whole story. He's the one who sent everyone to Egypt in order to save them during the famine. The story itself, when it comes on a larger sense, after Yosef dies, we know the beginning of Sefer Shemot, what happens to the Jews in Egypt? They become slaves. And the way the story is presented is it's, you know, the king, Vayakom el Hadash, Asher lo yadat Yosef, who didn't know Yosef, and I guess he decided to enslave the Jews. But certainly, you know, a reader of Tanakh, it doesn't take a lot of creativity to come up with the idea that the end of the story seems that it would certainly contribute to part of that hatred for the Jews. Because we're told at the very end of Bereshit that Yosef's way of how did he deal with the with the famine was he did the following. We're told, this is the very end of chapter 47. We're told, Vayomer Yosef Ala'am, the people, I'm skipping a lot because it's a very long chapter, but the people are struggling financially. They don't have any money to buy food. So first they sell their animals, and then they sell their land, and then they even sell themselves. And Yosef ends up buying all of that in order to feed them. And so by the end, Yosef says to them the following, Vayomer Yosef Ala'am, I have bought all of you and your land for Paro. I'm going to give you food for it. You're going to have to pay taxes on it. And they respond in kind, verse 25. You have saved us. We are grateful. We will now be servants to Paro. And while the Egyptians, all of Egypt, with the exception of the Kohanim, the priests, are all servants to Paro. Who is the one exception who are living nice and comfortable, who are well provided for? The Jews. The Jews, we're told, are living in Eretz Goshen. Yosef's providing for them. They do not have any of these troubles. It doesn't take a very, you know, creative reading to suggest that what precipitated the hatred of the Israelites in Egypt was Yosef's financial policies. That perhaps Yosef's financial policies might have, you know, been necessary at the time, but they certainly in the long run did not engender goodwill amongst, you know, for the Jews. They are something that feel predatory, and, you know, in the history of anti-Semitism, this might be the most, you know, reasonable reason to be anti-Semitic, in the sense that it's almost like, and this is the Jews really do control the world, and the Jews in this case really were responsible for the economic suffering. You know, Paro certainly is the one who gets the money, but Yosef's the one in charge of everything that happened here. And if that's true, so then when it comes to the parallel with Mordechai, the same thing could certainly be read as well. Mordechai is the, you know, the person who's in charge of these taxes, and the story ends on a high note, but we don't really know what happens afterwards. The story of Yosef also ends on a high note, but we do know what happens after Yosef is that people are not so thrilled with him. People, you know, end up, the Jews end up being exiled as being enslaved as a result. And it doesn't take much to think maybe the same thing will happen to Jews as well after Mordechai's gone. Maybe because of Mordechai's response. Indeed, many point out that if you take a look at verse 3, there's a rather interesting adjective that the verse uses. Ki Mordechai Yehudi Mishtamach HaHashverosh. Mordechai is the second in command. Ve'gadol la'Yehudim, and he's highly regarded by the Jews. Ve'ratsui l'rov echav, and he is popular L'rov echav, so the translation here says multitude of the brethren, but the word rov, at least traditionally, usually means, I would probably translate it as most of his brothers. Which implies, seemingly, that some did not, right? If most do, then some do not. So some want to read that almost as this subtle critique of Mordechai, that yes, it's true that many like Mordechai, but there were those who murmured, those who said, yeah, but maybe it's not great that Mordechai is taking such a prominent role in levying taxes. It's not great, it doesn't look great for the Jews to have this level of prominence here in this way. Perhaps that was part of the critique here. And in a larger sense, it's not just that, oh, Mordechai is, you know, the one levying the taxes, but Mordechai here is being praised because he has risen. We're told specifically in verse 2, Ufarshat Gidulat Mordechai Asher Gidelo Hamela. that the king has, you know, uplifted him to be second in command. The term Asher Gidelo HaMelech doesn't appear anywhere else in Tanakh except for one other person. And that's earlier in the book of Esther with Haman. Haman, too, was lifted up by the king. And what's happening in this story is, yes, it's true that Mordechai has replaced Haman. And, you know, it shows that the Jews have come back up and we're doing great. That's all fantastic. But there's also something rather significant about the fact that if Haman was someone who rose up quickly and then was immediately gone rid of very quickly, almost on the whim of the king because he was angry and he thought some type of thing was happening with his wife or whatever it is, the same thing might happen to Mordechai, who he too, based on the whim of the king, was raised. Perhaps on the whim of the king, he too, his own fortune will go down, will no longer, you know, stay so well. And if that's true, this way of reading the Megillah is suggesting that, yes, it's true, the story of the Jews ends positively here, but it's only the beginning. And there is more to say about this story that isn't written yet. And who knows whether it's going to be positive. And perhaps that brings us back to the critique, you know, inherent within almost that very first chapter we started off with, about the fact that there's no mention here about the Jews in Israel. Because the fact that there's no mention of the Jews in Israel, the fact that there's this constant talking about the culture in Persia, and only in Persia, means that not only is there a theological message about missing, you know, the divine plan of returning back to Israel, but there's also this sense of we're almost placing, you know, all of our eggs in this basket of relying upon a king like Ahasuerus to treat us well. And as we know, Ahasuerus is not someone who can really be relied upon. And the Megillah then, at least subtly, I believe, hints back to this point about the fact that, yes, the Jews in this moment are celebrating Nahpuchu, this real reversal, but it's not necessarily permanent. And it's, you know, it's temporal by nature, and it demands itself a more significant solution, much more than maybe the Megillah ends with. So that's what I'd say about Megillat Esther specifically. And I believe the point of Megillat Esther has a lot of, you know, ramifications for the way we think about our situation now in America and Israel worldwide. And that Megillah itself is not necessarily saying we have to make Aliyah. Certainly, if you ask Israelis, a very popular Israeli reading is that, in fact, it's a very strong critique against the Jews in Galut, and they should make Aliyah. I'm not always fully convinced that that's the full reading of what the Megillah is suggesting. But I do believe the Megillah is suggesting that we can't ever get too comfortable. That as much as we should try becoming active in government, and that Mordechai is someone we praise, we want to be Mordechai. There's a reason our kids, you know, dress up as Mordechai, because there's something, you know, something to be said about being active in government and helping the Jews as much as we can. It's also true that we can never fully rely on them. And that not only is the culture itself have some, you know, pernicious negative traits that we don't agree with, too materialistic, too hedonistic, etc., but it's also a little bit whimsical, and, you know, it's a little bit capricious and subject to change. And the winds of time might currently be in favor of Jews, but it might not always. And the message of the Megillah then is not only, you know, to think about, you know, the salvation of the Jews, but also to try thinking about more long-term what our plan is and how best to come across that. And I don't believe the Megillah necessarily comes up with an answer. Certainly the story of Megillat Esther would be very different if all the Jews were in Israel and no one was in the palace to be able to convince the king to save the Jews. It'd be a different story. But it's also true that just because we were in the palace, that doesn't make it everything, you know, that doesn't mean our situation is always going to be safe. So there's something about the Megillah then, which certainly challenges and raises these questions in terms of how we view the exile, how we view the diaspora, and what our role should be vis-a-vis the people in Israel and our own national destiny moving forward. That's what I got to say. Anyone have any thoughts, any questions? Do you want to share at this point?
It just, it's interesting, the insider who's also an outsider and that whole thing, which we experienced today as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact is that Esther is, someone made a comment about comparing Esther and Vashti. And absolutely, Esther and Vashti, one of the reasons some people suggest that Vashti is introduced, the whole story of chapter one is introduced, is to kind of point out the fact that we have three letters sent out. The first letter is about the fact that men control the households and that women are, you know, I guess a threat and that need to be subjugated. And then the second letter is about this other foreign people, the Jews, who also need to be subjugated in some way. And even if you're not a feminist in any way, it's hard not to read Megillat Esther that has these almost proto-feminist motifs of you know, the way that women here in this case are treated, or, and the way that it's parallel to the way that the Jews are treated as these, you know, this threatening outsider that might come and take everything away, take away all your nice things. So absolutely, there's something about being an outsider that, you know, throughout we still have, you know, from the beginning through the end, that exists throughout the story.
When you were reading the bits from Ezra, I was thinking about the end of the Megillah, Ritzui L'Rov Echav, that maybe the people who are not part of that Rov are the people in Eretz Yisrael who are the, you know, he's still running stuff from Shushan and part of Persian society, and they're still suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. There certainly seems to be, there certainly is a critique. Who L'Rov Echav is, it's not totally clear. We don't have time to do this. We had, a fourth year. Maybe we'll do this next year. But it's worth noting in that very long chapter, chapter 9, that we, you know, kind of like skip over. So we talked about it again the first week about the war part of it, the war that happens in that story. But there's also a whole number of verses, almost 25 verses plus, focusing on the development of the Chag of Purim and the letters that are sent out and how Purim is established. And it's too hard for me to say in 1 minute, but I'll briefly say that it's clear from the story that there seemed to be a need to re-emphasize the Chag of Purim more than once, because perhaps it wasn't accepted by everyone to begin with. That not even within the Jewish people, not everyone agreed to the way that history seemed to read itself in the story of Purim. And absolutely, I think there's certainly what to talk about in terms of, just because the perspective of the diaspora Jews and Jews in Shushan who are writing the story, read this all this historical event from one perspective, doesn't mean that the Jews in Israel have at all anything the same perspective, especially if their own, you know, financial situation has not really improved despite the events of the story. Okay, so if no one else has any other thoughts or questions, I want to thank everyone who attended the various shiurim. They are all recorded, so feel free to take a look at the past ones. And thank you for learning with me. And I hope this series has both inspired and been thought-provoking in terms of Purim specifically, but also more generally with regard to our own situation with the events in Israel since October 7th. As I kind of began with when I began this series, I really strongly believe Esther is the book that most speaks to our time and the perilous situation we live in with the way that the non-Jews look at us, with the double standard and all these different things. And it's very much something that I've been thinking about for a while. And I believe as much as I believe that when we celebrate Purim and we think about these themes, you know, Purim is so, as much a story about the past as it is about the present and the future. So thank you very much for attending, and I'm happy to take any other questions or any thoughts, and have a Purim Smichin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, go.
Yes, go.
Thank you. Bye.